PPI.org.
Disability and Progress. We bring you insights into, ideas about, and discussions on disability topics. Thanks so much for tuning in tonight. And thank you for Charlene Dahl, who is my research team. Also, Matt Finkel engineers this episode. Tonight, we are speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Neal. Dr. Neal will be discussing brain cancer. And Dr. Neal is an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Minnesota Medical School, as well as a neuro-oncologist with University of Minnesota Physicians. Good evening, Dr. Neal.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. I certainly always welcome the chance to increase awareness and education of brain cancer.
Could you first kind of introduce yourself as far as like what led you to choose to be a physician and how did you choose this particular field to work in?
Certainly. I knew from a young age that I wanted to become a physician. I went to college as a pre-med and got into medical school. During your last 2 years of medical school, you do a lot of rotations and you rotate through all the different specialties. And that's when I noticed that, you know, I kept coming back to my experiences on neurology. And I absolutely loved the patients I was taking care of, you know, the different diseases and conditions specific to the field of neurology. And so I matched into neurology residency at the University of Cincinnati. During rotations there as well, too, you get exposed to all the different fields of neurology. I always had an interest in cancer, and I really didn't understand the intersection between neurology and oncology until I did a rotation in neuro-oncology and absolutely fell in love with, you know, the types of patients that neuro-oncologists see, the type of, you know, the type of, you know, novel treatments that are being looked at to treat patients with brain cancer. And the field is really in its infancy as far as the potential that we have for treating patients with brain cancer. And so all of that really sparked my interest. I did a neuro-oncology fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering out in New York. And then I took my first faculty position here at the University of Minnesota. And so, you know, professionally, I see and I treat patients with brain cancer, but my academic focus is on clinical research and making novel treatments and investigational therapeutic options available to patients diagnosed with brain cancer.
Excellent. Thank you. I hear sometimes people talk about brain cancer and then brain tumors. Are all tumors considered brain cancer?
That's an excellent, excellent question. So cancer can be thought of as a cell that's not behaving how it should. So cancer cells maybe grow faster than they're supposed to. They replicate or they divide quicker than they're supposed to, and they don't follow by the normal patterns that, you know, normal cells would. And so as cancer cells grow, they can grow into a mass, and that mass would be considered a tumor. And so cancer cells can either be slow growing and thought of as more benign, or they can be very fast growing and thought of as being aggressive or malignant. So not all cancer cells are ones that need, you know, urgent treatment if they're slow growing. But if they're quick, that's when, you know, urgent and more aggressive treatment measures are needed.
You hear the terms malignant and benign, as you just used. Is that truly a definition of faster, slow-growing cells, or is there? Would you give more of an in-depth definition of those two things?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in general, how aggressive it is that we need to treat a tumor or cancer is based on, you know, its innate properties. And so benign tumors or benign cancer cells, they're just a little bit slower to grow, and also they might be more susceptible to radiation and to chemotherapy. More malignant cancers, those are ones that you need to be equally aggressive in your treatment approach. And so they might be thought of as maybe not being as responsive to treatment in addition to being pretty quick growing.
How many different types of brain cancer is there?
Yeah, another good question. So as far as different types of brain cancers, so the different types of brain cancers, they stem from whatever cell it is that for some reason developed a mutation to become cancerous. So there's cells that are very specific to the coverings of the brain, also called the dura of the brain, and that can give rise to a specific type of cancer called a meningioma. There's other cells that line the cavities that enclose the fluid of the brain. Those are called ventricles. And so ependymomas can grow from those specific types of cells. And then there's cells that are within the brain itself. And those are glial cells. Glial cells are helper cells that kind of, you know, clean up damaged cells. They can support blood vessels. And then glial cells give rise to glial tumors. They can be low-grade gliomas or they can be high-grade gliomas. And the most notable high-grade glioma is also called glioblastoma.
Ah, okay. You know, I don't know why, but I mean, I know blood goes throughout the entire body, but for some reason, I always think of the head is a little bit more protected, you know, than the rest of the body, like things that can go from your kidneys to your heart more easily than like from your heart to your brain. So if you get a brain cancer, can it metastasize somewhere else and vice versa?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point and excellent observation. So the blood vessels within the brain are actually protected by very, very secure gateways. And that's referred to as the blood-brain barrier. Mm. And so the blood-brain barrier is a selective checkpoint that only allows the passage of specific contents from the blood that we see in our circulation. So like you said, the blood pumping from the heart to the kidneys to the lungs, only a select amount actually gets through this blood-brain barrier to be allowed into the circulation around the brain and the spinal cord. And so collectively, the brain and the spinal cord is called the central nervous system. And so this is very, very important as a protective feature for us. So for example, if we, you know, become sick with, you know, a bacterial or a viral infection within our blood, we don't always get meningitis. For example, if you have the flu, you don't always have meningitis associated with it because the blood-brain barrier stops viruses and bacteria from your body's blood flow into the brain. This can also be the case for cells and can be the case for drugs and medication. So that being said, it keeps things out, but it also keeps things in. So in patients that have primary brain tumors, so brain tumors that start within the brain, we do typically do not see any of that cancer moving to the rest of the body. That being said, what can happen is because the circulation, you know, flows from the brain to the spinal cord, and there's also fluid, cerebrospinal fluid that surrounds the brain, the spinal cord. Sometimes those cancer cells can get into that fluid and it can move within the central nervous system. So it can move into the spine, for example.
So you can possibly get some of that then that might go to the brain in general? I mean, in general, it wouldn't, but so if somebody had, I don't know, colon cancer, and then they discovered brain cancer later on, would they assume that something maybe got there, or would they think of it as a whole new thing?
Yeah, very, very good point. So I think that brings up, the really, really important definition of a primary brain tumor and metastatic brain tumor. So primary brain tumors are ones that originate in the brain, and then metastatic ones are ones that originate, like you said, either in the colon or the breast or the prostate. And sometimes those cancer cells that originate in the colon and the breast and the prostate can develop really, really novel mutations, allowing them to get past the blood-brain barrier. And then they can become metastatic cancer to the brain and the spinal cord. Certainly that is possible. For primary brain tumors, one of the reasons that we think that those cells, number one, are pretty trapped in the central nervous system and don't get out, but if they do get out, we have seen clinical evidence on autopsy. So after a patient passes away, sometimes we look at other organs and we try to see, you know, if in fact, was there any brain cancer cells located anywhere else in the body?
Right.
And sometimes we see microscopic disease, but our thought is one terms the phenomenon seed and soil. So sometimes we have seeds, for example, brain cancer cells, but they don't have good soil elsewhere in the body. So meaning that even if they are able to get out, really the only place that those cells can flourish is in the central nervous system. So that's another reason why we believe that primary brain tumors don't move outside the central nervous system, and that's why we don't check the rest of the body. But we would think about that if someone had a history of cancer. Metastatic disease to the brain is 10 times more common than primary brain tumors. So actually our first thought is, oh no, is this cancer that the patient already has that has now moved to the brain? Because most of the time that is the case.
Wow, I had no idea. Gee, we're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Neal in regards to brain cancer. Dr. Neal, I'm wondering, are there dietary or lifestyle things that can affect brain cancer?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. So, you know, kind of like what we had just touched on before break is that metastatic disease to the brain is 10 times more common than primary brain tumors. And so evidence now has shown that, in fact, obesity can increase an individual's risk for many different types of cancer. For example, we know that esophageal, endometrial, colon, and breast cancer can be seen in greater likelihood in patients who are obese. And so good diet, exercise, and keeping a healthy weight can decrease one's risk of cancer. And so if you decrease the risk of a cancer in your body, then that decreases the risk ever of anything happening in the brain. In addition to that, we know that the patients who are more obese, too, can have a greater likelihood of a specific type of cancer in the brain called a meningioma. So the thought is that fat tissue secretes pretty high levels of estrogen. Estrogen is a hormone that's present in our bodies, both men and women, but more so in women. Mm-hmm. And so we think that when the fat cells secrete this insulin or this estrogen, it can increase one's likelihood for meningiomas. But the most common question that I hear with regard to diet happens in the setting of malignant tumors like glioblastoma.
Uh-huh.
There's some literature out there to suggest that a ketogenic diet, you know, might be helpful. In a ketogenic diet, very similar to like an Atkins diet, one would restrict or completely eliminate carbohydrates from the diet. And the thought is that the brain is a very, very unique organ and that it can only use simple sugars for its energy. And so if we restrict simple sugars from our diet, well, then the brain and the brain tumor won't have any food or energy source for it or to grow.
Huh.
But the thing that we neglect to know is that the brain is a critical, critical organ. And if we take in this fat and this protein into our diet, what happens is that our muscles, our liver that has the capability of taking all this food and transitioning it into simple sugars, it does so when the blood sugar gets too low. And so when the blood sugar gets too low, it changes all of this unhealthy food that we're consuming into simple sugar, dumps it into the blood, and it goes to the brain anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the brain doesn't have sugar, we go into a coma.
Right.
You know, it can't function. So really, you know, when somebody has cancer, it's very, very important to maintain a healthy and balanced diet because your body needs to stay as rejuvenated and as nourished as possible. So I tell everybody, you know, eat in moderation. Should you have a piece of cake? Sure, you can have a piece of cake. Should you eat an entire cake? Probably not, but none of us should.
Well, you know, and that's interesting because that study goes also against to like if the primary cancer started out being breast cancer, they suggest much less meat. So that's an interesting, you know, it seems like sometimes it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, the important thing that we're noticing is that, you know, the American diet is leading to a lot of, problems as far as health. So increase in cholesterol and diabetes, obesity, cancer risks. So maybe decreasing, saturated fats and, red meat consumption is just healthier for our body overall. And when our body's under particular stress, when it's trying to fight cancer and it's taking in all these really toxic chemotherapies, you know, giving your body all that great nutritious nutrients that it needs is really critical.
Are you finding with statistics that brain cancer or tumors in the brain are growing, like becoming more common or not?
No, kind of like what we talked about. So brain cancer makes up about only 2% of all cancers. So brain cancer in general is very, very low. And the incidence of, you know, someone getting a primary brain or spinal cord tumor, an adult person in the United States is about 30 per 100,000 people. So pretty low. Meningiomas and, you know, glial tumors like glioblastoma, they make up about 2/3 of all of these primary brain cancers. And so I think that, you know, the rates are still very small. If there was any uptick, particularly back in the 90s and the 2000s, I think that we just had a better way of starting to image the brain.
So just better technology revealed, you know, what it really was.
Exactly. There's been a lot of epidemiology studies looking at any connection between, you know, cell phone use and brain tumors, and we have not found any link with that at all. I think that we're just much better at detecting them now.
Have we found any preference with gender or race?
Yeah, great question. So the meningioma tumor, the type that's found kind of on the coverings of the brain, we know that that's more common in women. We think that just because women in general have higher levels of estrogen, and for some reason, we do find it more common in African-American women. For glioblastoma, which again is that very, very aggressive, very malignant type of primary brain tumor, we find that more commonly in men, and in fact, Caucasian men. And we're not quite sure why exactly that is.
Huh. Is there a difference between adult brain cancer or child brain cancer?
Yeah, a very, very big difference. So big that I don't see pediatric patients in my practice, because a lot of the type of tumors that affect children, we really don't see in adults. So medulloblastoma and a type of glial tumor called a diffuse invasive pontine glioma, those are commonly seen in children, and it's very, very rare for medulloblastoma to be seen in adults. And then glioblastoma, which is the most common malignant adult brain cancer, we really don't see in children. So there definitely is a preference as far as age. And again, why are children more prone or less prone to one and adults less prone or more prone to another? We don't quite know.
Huh, that is fascinating. So I'm wondering, how does someone get diagnosed with a brain tumor or brain cancer?
Yeah, so usually there can be two different ways. So first, someone can present with symptoms. So for example, someone can have a seizure event for the first time, or they can have new headaches, or they can have weakness or numbness, and that would cause them to, you know, talk to their primary care doctor or go to the emergency room, and then they would have a scan that could reveal something. The other way is that someone could have no symptoms at all, but let's say that, you know, they got in a car accident, or they were playing softball and they got hit in the head and, you know, had a concussion, and another reason for somebody to do an MRI of their brain. And that could be a way that they find it. And so anytime we find something on imaging, that doesn't confirm a diagnosis.
If people didn't have symptoms and perhaps they got hit and got a concussion or something, and then they did a scan and they might find it then, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. So even if we see a spot on imaging that doesn't confirm anything, it just confirms that there's something there that you know, either you were born with and is just the way that your brain developed, or it's something new that needs to be addressed. And the only way we could know is if a neurosurgeon did a surgery to go in and either take out all of that spot or part of that spot, and then the neuropathologist took a look under the microscope and let us know what those cells actually look like, if they look like it's a specific type of cancer or if it looks like it's just the way that your brain developed.
Wow, that sounds so scary. So there's not they wouldn't see the normal, like sometimes if you have another kind of cancer, you can get maybe, I think that's probably if it becomes metastatic or starts going throughout the body, you might take blood and you'd be able to see, you know, if it went somewhere, you'd be able to see some tests. But that doesn't work the same with the brain?
No, you know, circulating tumor cells, ones that are available through like a venous blood draw, we're noticing that cancer cells of the brain, you know, aren't in high enough circulation in the body. But there are some investigational research looking at taking someone's cerebral spinal fluid, so the fluid that covers the brain and the spine, and looking to see if there's any tumor cells there to potentially clinch a diagnosis. But that's still something that's being looked at from a research perspective and isn't necessarily commonly used.
I generally know that I hear about four stages when you talk about brain, or I'm sorry, when you talk about cancer in general, but that's not always true in brain cancer, correct?
Yeah, so brain cancers are not staged. So with a staged cancer, stage one means that the cancer cells really haven't moved outside of, you know, whatever organ they're originating in. Stage two, typically it means that maybe there's some cancer cells found in a nearby lymph node. Stage three and four talks about distant metastasis, so movement of the cancer elsewhere in the body. And similar to what we discussed earlier is that brain cancer, it's not going to be moving to other parts of the body. And so as a result, it's graded. And grading of brain tumors tells us a little bit about how aggressive it is. So how often are those cells turning over? Are they making new blood vessels? Those type of things is how we grade or give a little bit more of an indication of how aggressive a primary brain cancer is.
And do I understand that some brain cancers are just graded as grade four because they're so aggressive?
Yeah. So brain cancers can, like every different type of brain cancer has a different grading scale. But for glial tumors, for example, there's grade one, which is typically only found in children. Grade one glial tumors can be actually cured with resection or complete removal. Grade two tumors are low-grade tumors. Grade three tumors are intermediate. And then grade four tumors are also called glioblastoma. And so for grade two, three, and four glial tumors, unfortunately at this time, we do not have a cure for them. So we just aggressively manage these cancers, trying our best to prevent them from growing.
So what, if we can, I know this is probably the least favorite thing, but I wonder about mortality rate. It sounds like grade one has a pretty decent, that can happen. I don't know about grade two, threes, and fours.
Yeah. So we can go back to meningiomas. So meningioma is one of the most, or is, the most common type of benign primary brain tumor. And so of the meningiomas, 80 to 85% are grade one. And so sometimes meningiomas we see on imaging, they have very, very specific characteristics. And so when we anticipate something on imaging looks like a meningioma, sometimes we just watch it and, you know, it can be years and years and decades and we see maybe a couple centimeters of growth. So slow growing that we would never do anything for a grade one appearing meningioma. And so people would just live their normal lives, and, you know, that would not be life-limiting at all.
Mm.
Higher-grade meningiomas, so a grade 2 or a grade 3, those are the ones that can be refractory to treatment, so resection and radiation and sometimes the use of chemo. And so that could limit someone's life, but we're still talking, you know, years and years and years for that type of tumor. The most aggressive type of malignant brain tumor, the most common one, as I had stated before, is glioblastoma. And so glioblastoma is very aggressive, and even with resection and radiation and chemotherapy, there are still some patients who live about a year and a half with this type of cancer. Some that do better, certainly there's some that do better, and there are some that do worse too. But it all depends on the location of the tumor and, you know, how well they can tolerate treatment.
Can you give me a definition of uncle genes and suppressor genes?
Yeah. So we know that the body has certain mechanisms to protect it against cancer from developing. And so there are some genes that promote certain characteristics that cancer cells have. So similar to what we touched on before, you know, cancer cells are ones that like to grow really fast and like to replicate or divide and multiply too quickly. The DNA within our cells, it really is only to be used a couple times. And so we have cells that have a programmed time to die, and cancer cells kind of eliminate that program so that they become infinite. And so there's certain genes that code for that. And then there's other genes that kind of keep the cell in check. And so those would be like suppressor genes. And if for some reason there's a mutation in a suppressor gene and it gets knocked out, well, it makes that cell more liable to behave like a cancer would.
I see. So then are there specific, like, genetic markers that one might have for certain brain tumors or brain cancers?
Yeah, so as of right now, we aren't aware of any specific types of mutations or genetic predispositions to developing primary brain cancer. That being said, there are individuals who have syndromes that predispose them to having cancer in general. So such syndromes can be something called Lee-Fermani, Lynch syndrome, neurofibromatosis. Those are just innate problems within almost all of the cells in someone's body that would just predispose them to having cancer. So these patients probably have multiple different cancers, one of which could be a brain cancer. And so outside of those genetic syndromes, we aren't aware of anything that would predispose somebody to having brain cancer.
I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Neal. Dr. Neal, let's talk about treatments, because I don't know. I mean, cancer is always a scary word to me, but like when you hear brain cancer, it just sounds so devastating. It's right up there with blood cancer. let's talk about what the treatments might be and how you would do that.
Perfect, definitely. So with regard to brain cancer specifically, there's three different pillars that we stand on. So the first type of treatment that we consider is what's the role of surgery. So neurosurgeons are surgeons that are specifically trained to operate on the brain. And so a neurosurgeon would be the one to first evaluate the imaging and evaluate the patient and see how much of the tumor can be removed. So the brain is a very critical organ. And the thing is that certain aspects of our function are housed in different locations in our brain. So our ability to move is in one location. You know, our ability to speak is in another.
Right.
To feel sensation is in yet another. And so that's the role of the neurosurgeon to understand, you know, what are the functions of the brain and can he go in there or she go in there, you know, successfully and remove the tumor without harming the patient anymore or causing permanent damage. The next pillar would be radiation therapy. So a radiation oncologist would map out the different fields of radiation, because we know that, like many other cancers, brain cancer in particular is very susceptible to radiation therapy. And so that's something that we lean very heavily on. And then the last pillar, which is my role as a neuro-oncologist, would be prescribing the correct chemotherapy treatments. And so as far as chemotherapy, you know, we touched on the importance of the blood-brain barrier, preventing certain things from getting into the brain. And that's why, you know, I have so many patients in clinics saying, you know, I have a neighbor or I have a friend that had breast cancer, and they just had so many different chemo options. How come with brain cancer, you know, I don't have so many chemotherapy options? And that's because we need chemotherapies that can cross into the brain, cross that blood-brain barrier. Mm. And so there are some, but that's why we have, you know, such an emphasis on clinical trials and investigational therapies, because we want to find more. So we have conventional chemotherapies that just, you know, hurt any cell that's rapidly turning over. And that's why, you know, white counts and red counts and platelets can go down. We have targeted therapy. So we're learning that tumors have particular mutations that can be also seen in other tumors too. So for example, if we have a breast cancer that goes to the brain and we treat it with a particular type of chemotherapy and we do a molecular analysis on the primary brain tumor and we notice that it has similar mutations, you know, to other patients who have seen a really, really positive benefit with the specific cancer, even if it's indicated for breast cancer, for example, we could use that treatment option. And then we kind of are in the big realm now of immunotherapy. And what's the role of the immune system in the brain, and how can the immune system be turned on to fight brain cancers?
Can you talk a little bit about the risks of chemo, radiation, and surgery?
Yeah, certainly. So the brain, again, a very vital organ that doesn't do well with injury. So similar to patients who have had a stroke in the past, you know, there's some role for rehab, but, you know, sometimes strokes can be devastating because the brain can't recover. And so if the brain is subjected to injury from a surgery or from radiation, you know, sometimes it can cause people to have functional deficits that are permanent too. And so that's always a side effect that we have to be very, very cautious about. The other thing is the chemotherapy. So we want to make sure that the chemotherapy is not hurting the body too much. And so making counts go down too low, making people susceptible to infection or to bleeding risks. So it's just weighing all those potential side effects against what we believe would be a benefit.
And what's the idea of that sometimes people who have had certain cancers, if the cells are mutated as such, that by using radiation, maybe you cause higher chance of secondary cancer somewhere else. How do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, that's the difficult thing. So sometimes what I see in a clinic is a patient, for example, when they were a child, they had a blood cancer or they had, you know, a specific type of primary brain tumor that had to be treated with radiation to the brain. And so while it's caused that initial pediatric cancer to never come back again, unfortunately, sometimes as they get older and become adults, you can have a radiation-induced brain cancer. And so if radiation isn't used as a child, sometimes that cancer grows out of control to the point that the patient would succumb to the cancer. And so radiation is a very, very critical tool. But that's why these patients are followed so closely, even years and years and years and out from initial radiation exposure, because there is that potential risk that could give way to a secondary or radiation-induced primary brain cancer.
So immunotherapy now seems to be a big word that is out and something that people are really looking at, because presumably that may be a really great hopeful for a lot of different cancers, including ones that are really hard to handle. Where is the brain cancer and brain tumors with this?
Yeah, so again, the immune system and the way that the immune system tracks into the brain is again, different from the rest of the body. So we're up against a barrier in the fact that, you know, the way that the immune system works in the body isn't the same as it is in the central nervous system. In addition to that, we're finding that certain types of primary brain cancer, particularly glioblastoma, is very immunosuppressive, meaning that it sends out these signals that shuts down the immune system. Even if those cancer cells are within close proximity to the cancer, it can turn them away. And so those immune cells then wouldn't be able to work and fight those cancer cells if they're being turned away. And so that's what the biggest emphasis is number one, how can we stimulate the immune system in the brain? And number two, how can we take down this force field that such tumors like glioblastoma, for example, have put up so that the immune system that's now, you know, rip-roaring, ready to go in the brain, how can it actually start attacking the cancer cells? And so a lot of clinical trials now are investigating multiple different agents as a way to unlock the key to all these really, really important barriers that immunotherapy is up against within the central nervous system.
I wonder if you could quick touch on some research that was happening with dogs and brain cancer and things they were doing with that and trying to maybe segue into humans. Now, to be fair, with anybody who's panicking and says, oh, those poor dogs, my belief is that this was being done on dogs. There was specific breeds of dogs that had a tendency to get a certain brain cancer, I believe, either similar to or that humans got. And so they were treating the dogs and hoping that the same treatment would work in humans is my understanding of it. But you correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that is a very, very critical point. So there are particular dogs, ones that have short noses, so like bulldogs and pugs, that are predisposed, just part of their nature, to develop malignant glial tumors, so high-grade gliomas. You know, in humans, that would translate to glioblastoma.
Right, that's so, aggressive cancer, right?
Yes, yeah. So these are patients' pets that, you know, here at the University of Minnesota, our veterinarians were seeing, and they were just so troubled by the fact that these dogs that were very much loved by their owners were developing these highly aggressive brain cancers, and they were passing away within months of the diagnosis. Mm. And so at the University of Minnesota, we just have a phenomenal team of basic and fundamental researchers and a very vibrant veterinarian program. And then, you know, a clinical trial program, too, that saw a need. And so researchers at the University of Minnesota, they developed a vaccine therapy that has been used in these pets. And it's been found to be fairly effective in treating these pets who have spontaneously developed these brain cancers. And as a result, I became involved because it's my goal to then introduce this special vaccine immunotherapy into adult patients who have glioblastoma in a phase one clinical trial. This clinical trial, we were very, very hopeful that it would be opening the summer, but unfortunately with the COVID-19 pandemic, yes, the FDA and everybody has put holds on phase one clinical trials. I know, but we're still doing all of the work behind the scenes to get everything ready to go. We're still submitting to the FDA for their review. We're submitting to our IRB so that when we have the green light that we can start opening up clinical trials again, that we will have this available to start enrolling. So it's going to be delayed.
How would the vaccine work with the dogs then? You'd give the dog would come in with cancer and you'd give them a vaccine. How does this work?
Yeah. So the dog would come in, you know, maybe it would be walking abnormal or, you know, acting abnormal, would get a scan. There would be a mass that was seen. And then the veterinarian who is trained in doing brain surgeries on dogs would take the dog for surgery, take out as much tumor as possible, review the pathology. If it matches the type of pathology that we feel this vaccine and immunotherapy is effective for, they would then receive this treatment. And the treatment's an injection. And what it's looking to do is it's, again, looking to hone those immune cells to the brain. And then it's also looking to combat the immunosuppressive nature of the cancer cells. So the cancer cells that are telling the immune system to go away, it prevents the signal from being released. So now the immune system can start attacking these cancer cells that now have their shields down. And so that's the thought. And it's because of all the phenomenal work that the basic researchers and the veterinarians have done that have given us substantial enough evidence to say that we think this can be of benefit in adults. And that's why we're moving it into a phase one clinical trial.
And so for the canine group, how long have the these injections extended their life?
So for some of the dogs, it's extended them by months, 6 months to over a year. So a phenomenal improvement from what it was without such treatment available. And that's why we really think that we have a strong signal here.
And presumably, it would do the same in humans if we could get it in the phase one.
Yeah. Excellent point. That's the purpose of a clinical trial. So a clinical trial is a very, very big question. We have evidence to suggest that this would be an effective treatment. But that's why we're looking to put it in a clinical trial to use scientific measures to appropriately answer this question. But you can't put things into clinical trials unless they have the evidence behind it. And this certainly has some strong evidence.
Is there anything else we should know about upcoming research that's going on?
One treatment option that I neglected to talk about that a lot of patients do utilize is something called tumor treatment fields. A device that's also called Optune is used. There's a clinical trial, looking at the use of this device while someone's undergoing chemo and radiation. Usually it's used, after radiation is completed and the company is interested to see, is this an option for people who are newly diagnosed? And so that should be exciting because I think anything else that we can put in our tool belt to fight glioblastoma is something that we should certainly consider. But I would say that the University of Minnesota, again, COVID-19's shut down a lot of our work, but we're still working very aggressively behind the scenes to open up multiple different studies utilizing novel techniques in neurosurgery and then in immunotherapy and other chemotherapy options too, because our patients deserve to have the best treatments options possible, and that's what we want to provide them.
And presumably it already takes so long to get to these trial phases that I wish you guys the best of luck with that. I'll be excited, to have you back if this, once you can get going with it, to talk about it if it is a success. So
I would be thrilled to be able to come back and tell you that it's as successful as we are anticipating. So I will welcome that invitation.
Dr. Neal, I appreciate you being with me tonight, and thank you so much, and I hope you stay well. And good luck with the trials when you get to them.
Sam, thank you. This has been a wonderful hour. I've really enjoyed our conversation tonight.
Thank you. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of this show. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Matt Finkel engineers this episode. We've been speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Neal. Dr. Neal is discussing brain cancer, and Dr. Neal is an assistant professor of the neurology at University of Minnesota Medical School, as well as a neuro-oncologist of University of Minnesota Physicians. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org. Fresh Fruit is up next. Thank you all for listening. If you want to be on the email list, you may email me at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com to find out any upcoming episodes. That's disabilityandprogress, all written out, at samjasmine.com. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe and stay well and stay sane. Good night.
KFAI.org.